Talks with George Lane.
Good evening, it's 6pm and you're listening to the first ever edition of York Talks. I'm George Lane and from now until 7pm we'll be discussing and debating a range of national and international news stories. Tonight we're joined by panellists from URI News and Speech teams, along with the chair of the York Uni Lib Dems, Charlie Kingsbury, York Vision Deputy Editor Callum Shannon, the Reverend Rowan Williams and Professor Peter Rutland from the Department of Politics. Tune in and hear York Talks on UOY.
On air. On air. Online.
On demand.
York Uni's student radio station.
U-R-Y.
So, coming up on York Talk this evening, growing concerns over the threat of Russia in Ukraine. We'll be having an extended discussion about the legitimacy of the two different sides in this increasingly difficult crisis.
Putin has really thrown a spanner in the works, and he's using the Crimea issue to remind the West and to remind Kiev that Moscow has some muscle in the region.
The Lib Dem conference was in York last week. We'll be discussing the upcoming general election and the popularity of the Lib Dems. Also, were the Beatles bigger than Jesus? What about One Direction or Justin Bieber? On York Talks, we assess the impact of popular music on the popularity of Christianity. Plus, a look at the developments of good and bad scientific inventions in 2014 and their influence on modern-day society. Lots to come on the first ever edition of York Talks. Remember, you can join the debate on Twitter using @URYNews and the hashtag YorkTalks, or by sending a message to the website via ury.org.uk. But first, let's go over to Caris Brain for the latest international and national headlines. Over to you, Caris.
This
is York Uni's student radio station.
URY. Live from the URY newsroom, it's 6 o'clock. Despite search teams' best efforts, there's still no sign of a Malaysian Airlines flight that went missing over the weekend. Today, the area is being combed for the plane and it's been widened again in the search area. 42 ships and 39 aircraft are involved in finding the Boeing 777, which had 239 people on board. Two people have died and 18 others have been hurt after an explosion destroyed two apartment buildings in New York. The local utility board has received reports of a gas leak but didn't reach the area before the blast in Harlem. Around a dozen people are still unaccounted for. David Cameron's made a plea for a Middle East peace deal that could mean the end of all conflict. He's made his first trip to Israel since becoming Prime Minister. Speaking to the Israeli parliament, Mr. Cameron said Britain will oppose Iran having nuclear weapons, stand firm on combating Islamic extremism, and fight efforts to boycott Israel. And the Attorney General is to challenge a legal ruling over his decision to stop the release of letters written by Prince Charles to government ministers. The Court of Appeal says Dominic Grieve acted unlawfully when presented with the public, seeing the information. The Guardian has been fighting for the documents to be released. And in sport, UEFA has opened disciplinary proceedings against Bayern Munich after an offensive banner was shown by their fans during last night's Champions League game against Arsenal. A homophobic sign showing a crude picture of Mesut Ozil was displayed. Bayern supporters are accused of discriminatory behaviour. And finally, great news for festival goers is Glastonbury will continue for at least another 10 years. The festival has been granted a licence for the next decade, which will now run until at least 2024. Oh my God. Dolly Parton and Blondie and Lily Allen are among acts who have confirmed they'll be playing this June. A quick look at the weather, a fine evening and clear start to the night, but cloud forming overnight, lows of 2 degrees Celsius in York. URY News is more in an hour.
Thank you, Caris.
URY.
So, good evening. It's coming up to about 4 minutes past six. We are going on our first ever York Talks show today. Joining me in the studio, we have all our panellists for this evening. We're going to go around. We've got Caris. Hello, Caris.
Hi, George.
We've got Ben.
Good evening, George.
We've got Richard.
Buongiorno, George.
We've got Harry.
Hiya.
And finally, we've got Anna.
Hiya.
So we've got a lot of people in tonight who are going to be on our panel discussing things. As well as that, we've got numerous guest panellists, I did mention before, to talk about all the different interesting topic areas. As I mentioned, do join the debate online. We'd love to hear from you. Send me messages via the website ury.org.uk or go to @URYNews on Twitter to send your opinions. But first, we're going to go to the Ukraine crisis. Now, Ukraine is dominated by the news in the last few weeks and months after the protests against the government led to an uprising followed by Russian troops occupying the Crimea region in the south of the country. But what's led to all the trouble? Your Wise Ben Basin now takes a look back at the crisis and how it's unfolded.
Late January of this year, and the streets of Kiev are like a vision of hell. Burning barricades separate protesters and riot police, and two people die of gunshot wounds as the clashes turn deadly for the first time. The protests started months before, at the end of November of last year, when President Yanukovych's cabinet abandoned an agreement on closer trade ties with the EU, instead seeking closer cooperation with Russia. As the protests grew, the Ukrainian authorities clamped down. After 100,000 people attended a demonstration in the capital Kiev, the police launched their first raid on the protesters, arresting 35 and injuring many others. With December came the biggest demonstration yet. 800,000 people occupied the Independence Square in Kiev and stormed the city hall. Later on in the month, Russian President Vladimir Putin agreed to buy $15 billion of Ukrainian debt and reduce the price of Russian gas supplies by about a third. The Ukrainian opposition accused Yanukovych of selling the country out to Russia. One of their leaders, one world boxing champion Vitaly Klitschko, offered a solution to the troubles.
The president said at the round table that he is not afraid of snap elections. Then let him call a fair election. We're confident that it can be held in March 2014.
But no such election was called, and the protests continued. After Christmas, the Ukrainian parliament passed restrictive anti-protest laws. Soon after, protesters began storming regional government offices in western Ukraine. By the end of January, Prime Minister Mykolo Azarov had resigned, and the parliament had annulled the anti-protest law. The parliament passed an amnesty bill promising to drop charges against those arrested in unrest if protesters left government buildings. The opposition rejected the conditions. In mid-February, all 234 protesters arrested since December were released, and Kiev City Hall was abandoned by demonstrators, along with other public buildings. But on the 18th of February, more clashes erupted, with the reasons unclear. 18 were killed, including 7 police, and hundreds more wounded. Some 25,000 protesters were encircled in Independence Square. 2 days later came Kiev's bloodiest day for almost 70 years. At least 88 people were killed in just 48 hours. Videos showed uniformed snipers firing at protesters holding makeshift shields. 3 European Union foreign ministers flew in to try to broker a deal. Russia announced it was sending an envoy. The next day, President Yanukovych signed a compromise deal with opposition leaders, brokered by French, Polish, and German foreign ministers. But on the 22nd of February, Yanukovych disappeared, and protesters took control of presidential administration buildings without resistance. Arch-rival Yulia Tymoshenko, who was jailed for 7 years in 2011, was freed and travelled from Kharkiv to address Kiev crowds.
You are heroes. You are the best of Ukraine. It is you who changed everything, not diplomats, not politicians, not the world, just you. If somebody tells you you have finished your work and you can go home, don't believe it. Don't leave the square until we achieve real change.
At the end of February, pro-Russian gunmen seized key buildings in the Crimean capital, Simferopol. Crimea, which is in southern Ukraine, is a center of pro-Russian sentiment, which can spill into separatism. The region, a peninsula on Ukraine's Black Sea coast, has 2.3 million people, a majority of whom identify themselves as ethnic Russians and speak Russian. Viktor Yanukovych, in his first press conference since fleeing Ukraine, insisted he remained president.
I am eager, ready to fight for the future of Ukraine. In Ukraine, power was taken by nationalists, fascist youngsters. I did not run away.
Meanwhile, US President Barack Obama warned Russia that there will be costs for military intervention in Ukraine.
We are now deeply concerned by reports of military movements taken by the Russian Federation inside of Ukraine. Any violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity would be deeply destabilizing.
On the 1st of March, the Russian parliament approved Vladimir Putin's request to use Russian forces in the country. In Kiev, acting president Oleksandr Turchynov put the army on full alert. There were large pro-Russian rallies in several Ukrainian cities outside Crimea. Barack Obama told Mr. Putin in a 90-minute telephone conversation to pull forces back to bases. A few days later, on the 4th of March, Putin broke his silence, denying Russian troops had besieged Ukrainian forces in Crimea, asserting that they were just self-defense forces. On the 6th of March, Crimea's parliament asked to join Russia, planning to put the decision to a referendum on the 16th of March. World leaders denounced any such referendum as illegal. Here's UK Prime Minister David Cameron.
Today's vote of the Crimean Parliament to join Russia and the decision to bring forward an unconstitutional referendum to 10 days' time are serious steps in the wrong direction. The Ukrainian government has been clear that such a referendum would be illegal, and today European leaders have backed their position.
Pressure has been mounting from European leaders against Russia, with the US and France warning of new measures if it does not withdraw its forces from Ukraine. UK Foreign Secretary William Hague gave this warning.
We discussed our preparations to follow up on the decisions of the European Council that there will be costs and consequences for Russia if no progress is made, and indeed far-reaching consequences in the event of intensification.
With reports Russia is refusing to hold talks with their Ukrainian counterparts about the crisis. Yesterday, David Cameron told the House of Commons that they need to start playing ball.
They should work with the rest of the international community to support free and fair elections in Ukraine in May. No one should be interested in a tug of war. Ukraine should be able to choose its own future and act as a bridge between Russia and Europe.
Today, with just days until the planned referendum, Russian forces continue to occupy the Crimea. With mounting pressure from Western nations on Russia to withdraw, tensions in the region run high. Only time will tell whether this crisis will continue.
So, Ben Basin, thank you very much for that very professional package. It gives a very general look at Ukraine. So thank you for that.
That's okay.
So I'm joined in the studio by Anna, Karis and Ben. We're going to have a little bit of a chat about Ukraine. First thing to kick things off is quite an important question of, do you think Russia is just trying to make a statement around the world? Is that what it is? Are we doing all this just to turn their backs away and do it and get the, they've had the Olympics, they've had the Paralympics, now they want to just take a few countries?
I think there's an element to that. I think there's definitely an element of Russia trying to show the West, particularly, that they're still a big power and they can do this kind of thing, can occupy the Crimea like they have done. But the history of the Crimea, you know, I think it's a place that they've always kind of wanted. But recently, I think they haven't been that bothered about it, and so that's why I think it's come as quite a shock that Putin has just suddenly decided to occupy the region in Ukraine.
I think we could also see this as maybe a Western-centric way to describe the events or narrative for the events that have happened, in that if we turn this on its head, just to play devil's advocate, I mean, what Putin has done is very aggressive. We can't escape that. However, it is, if he didn't take the Ukraine and he is perceiving the EU to be coming in and taking this land, that would put NATO missiles right on his border. In which case, I mean, he's not justified in the means that he's doing it, but you can see his motive. So I wonder if that is maybe a Western-centric narrative of events that have gone on.
Karis, how far do you think it is a Western narrative of events? Are we just overemphasising it here? Is the BBC coverage and ITV coverage a huge thing, or is it just not a big issue, do you think, in Russia?
I think it's a very big issue. I think potentially it may just be more opportunistic than anything else, you know. Russia has invested interest in the Crimea. It's a very pro-Russian area. A lot of people are in favour of Putin and in favour of being part of Russia. So, you know, the overthrow of the Ukrainian government kind of, it gave room for this to happen. And so even if, you know, as been suggested, that interest weren't so high in the Crimea in previous years, that may not be a case that they weren't there. It's just it wasn't the time, especially with Sochi coming up, to do it. But obviously, I mean, as far as Ukraine views are concerned, I mean, in the 2010 election results, you had Yanukovych, he was very popular in Eastern Russia, and his opponent were decidedly not. But Eastern Ukraine is very, very pro-Russia, and so you can see it as you can see why Putin is saying that he's got invested interest in the Russian people and the Russian views of the area.
But then it becomes a massive problem because, like, the east of the country is, I think, like 30%, I think, of it is Russian speaking of the whole of Ukraine, and nearly all of those reside in the east. But the problem comes with in the Crimea, because it is physically attached to the rest of the Ukraine, whereas it is mainly Russian dominated. But yes, that's where Russia's supporters are, but that peninsula can't break away because it's relying on the rest of the Ukraine, which isn't so pro-Russian, for things like food and water and electricity. So I don't know how people are predicting where it's going. It's quite difficult to do so.
So it's been going on for a couple of weeks now, obviously.
Well, longer than that, George. It's been going on for millennia. The Mongolians, I believe, are the first to...
a fair while, and obviously in Ben's package, it was saying a bit of a chronology about it, starting off as a revolution, and now Russia's got involved. But what do you think the West can do to oppose these Russian actions? Is it quite simply we're just hoping it goes away? Is it simply going to just wander away, or is it going to have to get worse before it gets better?
Well, I think one of the options that the Western powers are looking at, of course, is sanctions, in terms of economic trade sanctions that they can withdraw from Russia. I was talking earlier with Peter Rutland, who we'll hear from a little bit later, but he was telling me about how if the West do put these sanctions on Russia, then obviously Russia are likely to retaliate by drawing their support away from trade to Europe and the US. Mm-hmm. And whereas in the US it shouldn't be much of a problem because they don't rely that much on trade from Russia. Europe, he was saying, Peter Rutland, that Europe actually rely quite heavily on stuff from Russia, and so whereas, you know, the average person in the US probably wouldn't notice if trade links were stopped to Russia, in Europe we're actually quite reliant on it, and so I think countries are going to be quite reluctant to do that if it's going to have a negative impact on themselves by sacrificing their links with Russia.
So it's kind of more than just the Russian vodka, obviously. That isn't just the only thing that gets out of Russia. And like you were saying, Ben, it is heavily focused on Europe as a continent. They would really feel the impact. Do you think Karis Putin is just going after Crimea at the moment? That's all he's kind of suggesting. Or do you think he could potentially be wanting the whole of Ukraine or other parts, getting back his Eastern Bloc? What do you guys think about that development?
Well, I'd hope not. I don't know if that's just being a Western optimism. I mean, who knows what he's got planned, but you'd hope that this is to do with what he claims to be Russian interests, and the plan isn't to move and completely take control. I think if that happened, there would be an extraordinarily strong reaction from the West. And as Ben said, nobody, and not Russia either, wants trade links with Russia to stop. You know, we talk about it being a detriment to Europe if we make these threats and we actually have to carry them through, but it would also be a massive problem for Russia itself. I mean, Russia's a tricky one. It's got such a big country, it's got so much power, we have to deal with it in so many, you know, it's got veto powers in the UN and stuff, and it's a massive balancing act, but it's also a balancing act for Russia as well.
I think it's interesting, really, that the Russians haven't recognised the new government in Ukraine yet, and they're refusing to even talk to them at all. And so it's interesting to think, what are they going to do if they're not going to try and take other regions of Ukraine? They're going to have to at some point recognise this government and, you know, start, you know, having a dialogue with them of some sort. But earlier I talked with Peter Rutland, who is the professor of government. He's a professor of government at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and he's visiting the politics department in York. I think this is probably a good point to hear from him. He started off by telling me a little bit about why the Crimea, the history of the Crimea region, and why the events of the last couple of weeks have been so important.
Crimea is a special case in Ukraine because it's a province which has a majority of ethnic Russians in the population, and it was a part of Russia for two centuries, but then was transferred to the Republic of Ukraine when it was part of the Soviet Union back in 1954. Then when Ukraine became an independent country in 1991, Crimea stayed with Ukraine, although most of the population, as I said, were ethnic Russians.
Were you surprised when Russian forces occupied the Crimea recently?
Yeah, everybody was surprised, because in the early 1990s, when Ukraine became independent, there was some debate about whether Crimea should stay with Ukraine or should go back to Russia, and there was some nationalist mobilization among the Russians in Crimea, and that was in the early 1990s. But Moscow didn't support them, basically, and President Yeltsin was the head of Russia at that time. He preferred to have good relations with Ukraine, so the Crimea issue became kind of forgotten. And so it really came out of the blue. Suddenly, we're back where we were 20 years ago, where people are questioning the borders of the former Soviet states. Putin is really thrown a spanner in the works, and he's using the Crimea issue to remind the West and to remind Kiev that Moscow has some muscle in the region. As part of the breakup of the Soviet Union, there was an agreement that Russia could keep a naval base in Sevastopol in Crimea, because that was it's the only deep water port on the Black Sea and had all these facilities there. So part of the deal was they would get to keep their naval forces in Crimea. So Putin already had 15,000 troops in Crimea. Now, he seems to have reinforced them since, but it wasn't like he invaded by rolling over the border with no assets in place already. This is pretty unusual, because Russia generally was kind of stressing the importance of sovereignty and borders, and they had their own secessionist movements in Chechnya, obviously, so it was a big deal for them that the Soviet borders should have been kept. And Putin's basically torn all that up, and so he's really gone out on a limb, and he's really broken the rules. It's a done deal now, because the West is not going to get into a military confrontation with Russia. It's pointless. Both sides have nuclear weapons, and nobody wants to start an escalation between two nuclear powers. So NATO is going to stay out of this, I think. The question is, what does Putin do next? He's got hold of Crimea. It looks like he's not going to give that up. And the fear is that he won't stop there.
So how do you see this crisis developing? Do you think Putin's going to go further?
Hopefully, now that he's made his point, now that he's got his message out, hopefully things will kind of cool down. But as I said, given that he's invested so much, it would be quite humiliating for him to kind of take his toys and go home kind of thing, and let Crimea return to the status quo ante. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, Crimea may be annexed to Russia altogether, or it may be left as an independent country, or maybe even be left within the technical sovereignty of Ukraine, but with such high autonomy that it's basically a Russian fiefdom. We're not going to see those Russians leave Crimea. The Russian troops leave Crimea. But the big puzzle that nobody can really answer is, what does Putin want in terms of the rest of Ukraine? Because Putin is still refusing to recognize the new government, refusing to talk to them even. And so what does he expect is going to happen next?
So that's very interesting. Peter Rowland there from the Department of Politics. Very interesting points that he picked up on, talking about the future, how that's going to develop over the next couple of months. So we've already seen this crisis going on for a fair amount of time. I know, how do you foresee
it? I mean, looking at the history of it, it is nothing new, is it? I mean, Ukraine translates as borderland, and it's something that has continually been kind of fits together. And as a result, I think that this isn't really anything to be alarmed about if we looked historically. However, looking at the images that have come across in the last few days, obviously Putin is continuing to take military action. He is continuing to send in reinforcements following a phone call with Obama, I believe. And as a result, there's these startling images of Russian troops surrounding Ukrainian bases, standing 3 meters away from the gates and declaring that they must surrender their weapons inside the base. The base is refusing to do so, and so they are just standing there in complete silence. They're refusing to make any comment, and all it is they're waiting for... It could so easily happen. It's such a volatile atmosphere that a scared soldier will make a shot, and who knows how far that's going to escalate. Is it going to have ramifications for as far as the... or further into the EU, or is it just going to stay contained in Ukraine? I think it's quite scary stuff. Such a volatile country and environment at present.
Well, some very interesting thoughts there. We've been discussing this on York Talks for the last 10, 15 minutes or so. We have covered all that we can on Ukraine for now. I think all that's left to do is keep an eye on the news. So this will be a developing story over the next couple of weeks. We might even be able to touch on it again after Easter. But for now, Ben, Anna and Karis, thank you.
Tune in and hear York Talks on your way.
So, next up, cutting students' fees was one of the biggest promises by the Lib Dems in the 2010 election. But after many protests, the fees still increased, betraying the student group and general population's trust with the future of the Lib Dems as a negative. Can the Lib Dem conference promote their policies and future voters to side of them? And as the new tax cut they claim to have pushed was against the Conservative wish, will this have an impact? Now, Richard Dunn has covered the Liberal Democrats' spring conference that happened in New York last week. He assessed the building of a trust for the Lib Dems and what may need to change.
It was the Liberal Democrat conference last week to promote current policies, future policies and rally supporters. The most prominent speech in the conference was by the Treasury Chief Secretary Danny Alexander. His speech in the conference outlined the Liberal Democrats' most proud policy and what implications that have for future workers and future government.
Just 4 weeks from now, over 25 million working people will benefit from being able to earn their first £10,000 tax-free. That is a tax cut of £700 that has also taken 2.5 million people out of tax altogether. We're not stopping there. Every day, in the run-up to the budget, Nick and I are drawing strength from our party's campaign to press for a further rise in the allowance to £10,500. That would be another £100 cut for working people. We are fighting just as hard to deliver yet again for British working people. To lead our team that will negotiate with the other parties, should the British people deliver another hung parliament. Our party will fight the next election with our own ideas, our own policies, our own values, and no one else's. It will be our aspiration to raise the personal allowance dramatically again, to raise it to £12,500.
It was not all tax policies in the Liberal Democrat conference. EU elections became a significant point for Nick Clegg. However, it would seem the conference was to promote more trust in the Liberal Democrats' ability to make policies and to stick by them, also to promote their influence in government, as concluded by Danny Alexander in this speech.
This tax break was promised by the Liberal Democrats, but resisted by the Conservatives, fought for by the Liberal Democrats, and people know that it is being delivered by the Liberal Democrats.
The concluding speech and points by Danny Alexander at the Lib Dem conference may seem rousing, however, not all agree who were there at the Barbican.
Damn on you!
Those were the voices of the demonstrators outside the Barbican whilst the Liberal Democrat conference was in full swing. The TUC had called for the electorate to demonstrate for a better way of using policies to recover the economy rather than the austerity measures in place. Over 3,000 demonstrators had arrived, but mainly to voice their complaints for propping up the Conservative policies such as the bedroom tax, also wanting to voice their betrayal they had received from the past.
So that was Richard there with a bit of an overview of the Liberal Democrats conference last weekend. And we're joined in the studio with, again, Caris Brain, but also we've got Charlie Kingsbury, who is the chair of the Liberal Democrats at the University of York. Also with him, sat to his right, is Callum Shannon. He is a member of the Labour group at York and also went along to the rally that was outside, the TUC rally. And finally, Richard, who will be leading this discussion. Over to you, Richard.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, George. So, what has the conference meant to you two? So, with you, Charlie, so what's the conference for you?
Well, I thought it was quite a positive time at conference. It was an opportunity for us to set out our sort of communication in the future. So, you know, for example, our
policy on tax, which was mentioned earlier, £700 tax cut to workers, we're going to extend that to £800, meaning that those who are on the minimum wage won't have to pay income tax at all. So, very positive view.
So what about you, Callum? Do you have an alternative?
Well, I think it's very ironic for a start that they decided to hold it at the Barbican Centre, a building which the previous Liberal Democrat City Council administration closed down. Also, I think it was very ironic they decided to hold it in York in the first place because, to be honest, I didn't approve of the previous Liberal Democrat City Council administration's work. They were quoted, certain councillors were quoted on going for re-election saying York doesn't need more jobs, which we clearly do. We're in the north, things are hard. although, to be honest, the situation here in York's better than a lot of the rest of the North. I think the Liberal Democrats were trying to say our economic policy isn't affecting the North, and so they decided to come to York, which has a stronger economy as part of the Southeast, and I think that they were just trying to mask the damage they're doing.
Well, I think it's actually quite interesting that you would bring up that our economic policy isn't affecting the North, but I would actually disagree with you there, in that I think that it is having quite a positive effect. A £3.2 billion scheme called the Regional Growth Fund is actually helping places like York. Leeds and York in the north, you know, are places that are benefiting quite substantially from that. So an example there being a £64,000 grant for York Metrics, which lead to investment in local software systems, more jobs for York, more investment in manufacturing.
Well, I agree the situation in York is pretty rosy, but I put it more towards the new Labour administration, which we now have in the city. They've been promoting business in the UK and abroad. They've received a recognition for it from The Economist. They described York as a perfect post-industrial city, and they said if things had carried on the way Liberal Democrats intended, then we'd be, I quote, a chocolate box city without a chocolate factory.
Well, thank you, guys. You know, we obviously we've got two very good divided opinions, but firstly, came out today in Parliament, Prime Minister's questions. Harman is the most significant voice in that. We actually have a clip of it as well. Attacked Clegg on his policies and whether he sticks to them.
At their spring conference last week, Lib Dem ministers were falling over themselves to denounce government policies and even their own departmental colleagues, describing them variously as unfair, absurd and hated, yet they keep supporting them.
Harman there was talking about the bedroom tax. However, Clegg very quickly responds to that as well.
We're trying to sort out the mess that they created. They issued a report a few months ago that says that hundreds of thousands of youngsters on level two apprentices are, get this, dead weight.
So, very powerful stuff, especially debating the argument. Karis, do you have any thoughts, obviously not belonging to any political body?
No, I'm relatively impartial, I have to admit, politically. I have to admit, especially coming from a student perspective, having voted in the last election, I find it very difficult to even imagine trusting the Lib Dems again, especially coming up to the next election. I just think that a lot of the policies, they've had no backbone as far as their time in government's concerned. They've said that they're going to do things and then found that actually they haven't got necessarily the power to do things. They've had to back things that the Conservatives want to do. And I know that I'm not necessarily somebody who's absolutely completely involved in politics, but from taking an outsider perspective and seeing things, I just don't think that Lib Dems have endeared or at all proved themselves to the general population.
Do you think that's what the conference is for then, to sort of big up the whole tax
Absolutely,
cut?
And I think especially coming as far as going to the tax cuts, they're saying things that people want to hear, and it all sounds good and it sounds rosy and it's coming at a very convenient time, but it begs the question of they're saying the right things at the right time, just like they did before the last general election. But is this going to be something that everybody goes, oh, that's lovely, I'll give them my vote, and it doesn't happen again?
Well, on one hand there, you seem to be saying that we don't have a backbone, that we haven't got anything to brag about, but then you're also saying that we've used this conference as an opportunity to brag about what we've done. So,
I'm not saying you're bragging about what you've done, I'm saying you're bragging about what you say you can do.
No. There's quite a good number of examples here of things that we have done in government. You know, it's not just the £700 tax cut, which obviously will be, increasing, but there's also the £2.5 billion pupil premium, which is going to help students, the most disadvantaged of students. There's an example of 1.6 million apprenticeships that we've helped create, over a million jobs that we've helped create in the private sector, and it's going to be extended to over a million more. And stuff like shared parental leave, same-sex marriage, wouldn't have happened if it weren't for the Liberal Democrats in government.
I'm not saying that you haven't done anything. I think, like, go to Callum. I'm just saying that when times have gone tough, they seem to have caved to the Conservatives.
I concur, Karis. On the subject of a few things you said there, you brought in the pupil premium, but you scrapped the education maintenance allowance. Equal marriage wouldn't have happened without Labour votes either. And the income tax threshold, while it may be a vote winner, it doesn't really reduce the amount of tax paid by the poorest members of society very much.
Well,
a majority of the tax comes from VAT, and well, you've raised that.
Thank you, Callum. There's obviously a lot of policies cutting off. Is there any finishing points we want to say? Like, should we continue to trust Lib Dem, Charlie?
Well, certainly. I'm not going to say anything other than that, am I? It's a point of, you know, you either go back after the next general election to a two-party system, which has constantly failed us, or you place your trust in the Liberal Democrats again to stop. To stop Labour from wasting our money, to stop the Tories from making us into an unfair society. So.
Okay, great, thank you very much. Thank you all for coming, and have a great opinion and great debate, thank you.
Well, it's officially now coming up to 6:35. You're listening to York Talks. We're just over halfway through the first programme of York Talks. We've had some great discussions so far, and we've got more to come before 7 p.m. Remember, you can take part in tonight's programme by tweeting us at URY News using the hashtag York Talks, messages via the website on ury.org.uk, or text us on 07851 101 313. So already in the show, we have heard from Professor Peter Rutland from Department of Politics, along with our panellists on the issue of Ukraine. This is certainly an issue that isn't going to go away, and so keep an eye out on that on the news over the Easter break with the team from York Talks is off air. Now, we haven't had any messages so far. The only one we've had so far is to say, nice one, Callum. So obviously a bit of support there for Callum Shannon on there. Remember, you do send us those tweets and messages, we will read them out. But for now, let's move on to the next subject. Joining us for our next discussion is the Reverend Rowan Williams and our panellists Harry, Anna and Ben. Now, for those of you who are thinking that we have the Archbishop of Canterbury live on the show, unfortunately it's not. It would be good to point out that this is a different Rowan Williams, and in fact she's the Anglican chaplain for the university. Tonight's ethics and religion topic is around popular modern music and the impact of that on religion, and Harry joins me now in the studio to explain the context behind this discussion.
In March 1966, 48 years ago, John Lennon claimed the Beatles were bigger than Jesus. The remark caused outrage across the world, with Beatles memorabilia being publicly burnt and their music banned on radio stations. Lennon later apologised for the controversial statement.
Well, I suppose the things I said are accurate, but out of context. It was a long time ago, but I just didn't mean what everybody thinks I meant, you know. I'm not anti-Christ or anti-religion or anti-God, you know.
Did you mean that the Beatles are more popular than Christ?
When I was talking about it, it was very close and intimate with this person that I know who happens to be a reporter. And I was using expressions on things that I'd just read and derived from about Christianity. Only I was saying it in the simplest form that I know. More popular than Jesus and so on.
Nowadays, One Direction claim the charts as Britain's top English boy band. Unlike their predecessors, One Direction are, for the most part, wholesome and parent-friendly. However, if One Direction claimed they were bigger and more influential than Jesus, would their remark be taken seriously? There are approximately 2.2 billion adherents to Christianity worldwide, but there is a continuing decline of followers in the developed world. Christianity is reportedly losing 7,600 people in Europe every day. Meanwhile, One Direction's album sales are on the increase. It is not uncommon to hear about dedicated teenage girls who would more than happily give away their shoes collection to go on a date with Harry Styles. Our panel will discuss, is One Direction's growing popularity and Christianity's decline reflective of a changing environment? Are teenagers as keen to know more about Jesus as they are to hear the latest pop song? Can Christians enjoy music by dubious rock stars, even if their lyrics are clean? Tonight we discuss, are One Direction better than Jesus? That's what makes you
beautiful. So we're joined in the studio, as we said, with the Reverend Rowan Williams. The first question to kick off is, I've been asked to ask about your music taste. What sort of thing would you normally listen to on an evening? Would it be any popular music? Would it be a bit of One Direction? Or what's your particular favourite interest?
I can't say that One Direction would be my music of choice, fortunately. I have to say that my tastes run more to the classical, but if I was listening to something in the more popular genre, it would probably be soft rock, bit of cheese, the sort of thing you might hear towards the end of the night at Willow, more than
I completely agree.
So the question that Harry brought up in his initial introduction was around the extent of types of music. Obviously, some types of music are a little bit more extreme than others. And so the first question to really discuss about is, can Christians listen to unchristian music? Is music just a preference, or should Jesus' teachings lead a Christian's music taste? Is there any sort of direction in this discussion, does the panel think?
Well, as a Christian, I mean, I'm 21 and I just listen to what I like, but whether that's Miley Cyrus or anyone actually, but maybe I'm beginning to judge myself and think more seriously about Christianity. So I'm wondering whether I should reconsider what I listen to.
I think that's a very interesting point, because it's not necessarily a conscious choice that you are. I think popular music is very much about the tune. That's very exactly what it is. It's popular. And I don't think it is necessarily the demand from an audience to want things which are necessarily, as we've been saying today, unchristian, inverted commas, big ones. But I think it's more that we don't appreciate that actually just what is being said. I mean, certainly I don't. Like, One Direction, I'm just like, that's a great tune. I really like that tune. I don't necessarily think, oh, the ethical implications of what Harry Styles is singing is X, Y, and Z. And I think maybe it's to turn the argument a bit on its head. Actually, is it not? It's not the audience wanting the stuff from which is slightly less Christian, inverted commas again. But actually, it's the other way around. And is it the fact that Christian people are listening to things and they're not realising that it is not so, not necessarily quite in line with their views, would be what I'd say.
Yeah, and I think whether you're Christian or not, I think there's a question there about the responsibility to think beyond the tune and say, what are these words saying? The question about, say, blurred lines, for example.
Yes.
Is that a song that glorifies violence? I don't think you have to be a Christian to ask questions about the ethics of lyrics that might encourage dodgy behaviour.
But also things like blurred lines and the things which have been controversial and deemed probably unchristian and just offensive generally in the popular music business recently have been things which have been incredibly visual. So I still wonder if that thing remains. That it is actually, you don't listen to the lyrics that you're consuming. It is very much a visual thing. Like, blurred lines was definitely controversial in the way that it was set up. Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus is another one which obviously has gone, or everything Miley Cyrus touches, it just turns to controversy. So I question whether it is it still that we don't listen to the lyrics?
Just to carry on with that point, I mean, when I'm listening to music, I'm relaxing. So even if I'm listening to something like Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke, I'm not thinking about the sexual undertone of the music. I'm enjoying it for what it is. Whereas maybe when I go to church, I'm very actively being a Christian and I'm listening to the sermon and I'm thinking, this is what I'm going to do this week. And I'm wondering whether, when you listen to lyrics, Rowan, whether you feel inclined to act in certain ways on what you hear. Do you think it affects you?
I think to an extent it does. And because I'm a linguist by training, and before I was ordained, I take words very seriously. And I think the Christian faith takes words very seriously. So I don't find it that easy to dissociate words from music. Like anybody else, I'm quite capable of using music as escapism and entertainment, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I also think that we have a responsibility to listen to the words that are presented to us, and, you know.
If you, for instance, I mean, I'm a fan of Shakira, I mean, and she doesn't write all her songs in English. But if you listen to her songs, maybe you wouldn't understand the lyrics because you don't speak that language. Can you still enjoy them, even though she might be talking about something which is unchristian in the traditional sense, although you don't understand those lyrics and therefore you can't be influenced by those lyrics?
Yes, I think there's probably an extent to which you can. Just as in the old days, a lot of church music was in Latin. You don't necessarily understand everything that's being said. But it's still good music.
But equally, if we look at Blurred Lines again, sorry to keep bringing this example up, but that got to number one, essentially. So it is a popular piece of music. However, as soon as somebody pointed out, and well done on humanity for this one, as soon as someone pointed out, goes, oh, that's maybe a bit inappropriate, actually, it turned, and there was a complete sea change. But to begin with, it was a very popular piece of music. So again, I question, just to contradict a little, just slightly, do we listen to lyrics when we hear, or do we just want a driving bass line?
So for me, I'm not sure I mean, what is, to you, Rowan, what is Christian music? Does it have to be music that is written by a Christian about dedication of your life to God, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it depends how you look at it. I mean, music that calls itself Christian, obviously, is likely to be music that's written by Christians for Christians. But you can pretty much use any music you like, as long as it has an appropriate message. I mean, how much popular music's written about love, for example? That fits in perfectly with a Christian message. And why would it not? But you can equally use, say, for an example, an ABBA song to think about the love of God. I've done that. I'm not ashamed to own that. I said I like cheese.
And what song would that be?
That would be Take a Chance on Me, in fact. If you listen to the lyrics of that and imagine God talking to you through that. It's actually quite a challenge for Christians to do that, but it really, really works. It sounds ridiculous, but it actually works.
So Sweden's a very secular community, and I don't think ABBA were Christian. So in some sense, atheists can actually write Christian music.
Yeah, and the argument goes the other way as well, because if you listen to some Christian music that's played in churches, and you put your boyfriend or girlfriend's name into the song where it says Jesus, it works equally well. It can work both ways round.
So some very interesting points there. Obviously, we've moved from a discussion from the idea of songs having a negative message, and it's nice to finish on the positives of music and how, although there's been a change over the last many decades, it can be perceived as to be a good and positive thing, even though there are some negative and controversial songs. From what you were saying, Rowan, it's not necessarily a Christian issue, but it's just, as a whole, people look at the morals of songs and can make them judgments regardless of whether they were following the Christian tradition or not.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us, Anna, Harry and the Reverend Rowan Williams. The next point of discussion will be the final one for tonight, and it's a quick one on technology. Now, we turn our minds to technology here on York Talks. Up next, Anna Henley talks to Emma Gibbs and resident gadget expert Elizabeth Shuker about the worst gadgets of the last 12 months. Which invention will be crowned the worst of 2013? Let's find out.
Good evening, I'm Anna Henley, and I am joined by Emma Gibbs and Elizabeth Shuker as we discuss the worst inventions of 2013. Hi guys, thanks for joining me.
No problem, hello.
So we're gonna start with these terrible inventions, with each of you giving me 30 seconds as to why the invention you have gone away and chosen and researched carefully is the worst invention of the last 12 months. Emma, let's start with you. Give us the name of your invention and you've got 30 seconds to tell us why it is so terrible.
Right, I'm going for Candy Crush. And any sort of those sort of apps that have been invented in the last 12 months, because I love them so much and they absorb my entire life. I spend all of my time either researching for uni or just endlessly killing little bits of candy or pressing a button so that a bird flaps over some pipes. I used to spend all of my time reading or watching documentaries or something, and now my brain has turned to this sort of greenish goo, or maybe it's multicoloured like the candy in Candy Crush, and I just can't do anything other than endlessly
tap on
a screen.
Okay, Emma, that is 30 seconds. We'll stop you there. You are quite impassioned about that. Lizzie, let's come to you. Same drill. Can I have the name of your worst invention of the last 12 months? And you have 30 seconds to tell us why it is so bad.
Okay, so I'm not entirely sure whether I've got 30 seconds worth of information to give you about this particular invention, but I'll break it down for you. This is the iPad Periscope made by iToy. The kind of concept of this is that it's a periscope that you attach to your iPad, so that when you're on a Skype or video chat, it looks as though you're standing a normal conversation distance away with the person you're talking to, as opposed to holding them up in front of your face as if you're about to kiss them. So that's the niche these people are trying to fit. They're trying to make a video chat feel a bit more like day-to-day life because you're standing 2 feet apart rather than 30 centimetres apart. But in the end, you just end up with your, you know, snazzy, flashy little slim iPad with this big grey attachment that looks somewhat like a paper shredder.
Okay, well, thank you, Lizzie. That sounds Fabulous. So my invention that I think is absolutely terrible came out of the CES fair in January, and it's called Mother. And it's a machine-to-machine device which basically allows a mother to track her child. And it comes with like these little like bullet pill things that you can put onto children's backpacks, you can put them into their rooms, you can put them in the fridge. It all feeds back to this central creepy-looking device which looks like a Russian doll. And it also feeds every single piece of detail, data even, such as temperatures, times that people are doing things, the movements people are taking, into this central system, which then chucks it back out into your iPad. So a mother, from the sofa, has everything that her daughter or son has done in a day, and you can get it to remind people to do things. So it's not strictly a mothering thing, it's also to remind you to take your pills on time, to remind you to go for a swim if you're exercising. It's just quite invasive. So, Lizzie, Emma, we have got here mother versus iToy, the periscope thing, to be specific.
Absolutely.
And we also have Emma's Candy Crush. I'm going to start, Emma, with your Candy Crush. Now, I think it's quite a good thing. If you're sitting there socially, e.g. on the tube, you have no Wi-Fi, you have nothing like that, you can still play it and you don't have to do human interaction. Or is this the problem that you have with it?
I think the problem is that there are different ways to not do social interaction where you could still be getting something rather than just mindlessly destroying bits of candy. You could read a book, you could watch stuff on YouTube, which isn't that intellectually stimulating, but it's a little bit more, let's be honest. And the fact that you could actually maybe just talk to the person on the tube, maybe you'll make a friend.
I do think this is an interesting one because often you get people of the perhaps generation ahead of us are often talking about how we all have smartphones now and so we are just wasting our time on ridiculous apps and our brains are turning to mush and we can't imagine anymore and we don't read anymore and we don't look out the window of trains anymore, and it's all very romanticised. But I think there's no real difference between playing Candy Crush and playing Sudoku, and there's no real difference between playing Flappy Bird and playing kind of brain teasers in the back of the Times. So I think it's kind of relative, but I don't think there's any real difference. I think it's still kind of a brain teaser exercise, like perhaps not Candy Crush, but necessarily, but a lot of apps, they are like puzzles, and I don't think there's anything necessarily inherently wrong with that.
See, as much as I just said what I did, that's not actually how I feel. And I like when I've got Lizzie to my right, and she's very conscious that I hate all things technology, which you can just do in real life. And for me,
like smash candy,
it's something that gets in the way, and is a screen that's getting in the way of you actually using, if you were, for instance, using a Sudoku to occupy yourself. You haven't got that pen, paper, tangibility. I think that your invention is also terrible because, Lizzie, the iToy also encourages this screen between two people, and it's trying to make real life simulated by technology. But you've got real life right there. Why use technology to try and simulate something that is right in front of you?
The iToy thing I don't get. I don't understand video calling on phones for a start. I don't understand why you'd want to do it. You've got a Skype or a computer screen. I don't see why you need to call somebody on your phone and see their face.
Meet up with them for coffee.
Exactly.
Meet up with them for coffee.
I think it is interesting that these are the problems that you guys have with it, because obviously I presented it as the most ridiculous invention of 2013, and I think it's probably partly from my perspective of it just looks absolutely absurd. I don't kind of inherently have a problem with like a video chat. I think if you're walking down the street, you know, you've got like a 20-minute walk, you know, it's nicer to have a video chat than a phone call. I mean, you kind of look ridiculous, but who cares? But so I think in that sense, I don't really have a problem with it. But I think it's just, I don't see anyone using it. Like, it just doesn't seem to have a market at all. It's like they've invented a niche out of nowhere and pretended like there's kind of a market demand for something that there really isn't. I think they should just develop holograms instead.
See, I'm on the side of holograms. I like a hologram. Let's have holograms.
But I think, Lizzie, the iToy, this periscope that you attach to your iPad, is a very extreme example. And the reason that you have a problem with it is the same reason I have a problem with the mother and with Candy Crush and with screens and technology in general, if it's going too far, well, too far, inverted commas, in my opinion, is that it is this thing which is trying to do a job which just already, it doesn't need to be made easier. This is not something that needs to happen. But the means by which it's done it are particularly cumbersome. And I think that the mother does this in the same way. You could just be very organised. You could be an organised mother. Heaven forbid that should be the case, because no, there is a cumbersome way where you attach little tiny pellets to your children and you track them instead. And I think that, for me, is the iToy encompasses the problems that I have with all the
of these pieces of technology. I'm quite opinionated on this topic, as you can tell.
I think these, especially the mother, is definitely kind of symptomatic of something potentially good but done badly. So I think at CES, where Mother was released this in January this year, there were a lot of other things that fell under the Internet of You category of things that were monitoring heart rates and insulin levels, for example. So I think whilst the mother is absolutely absurd, and again, it kind of just looks ridiculous, which is probably what bothers me most, I think there definitely are degrees to which it's very useful technology, because we're all used to having baby monitors in one room and parents in another room listening, and this is just kind of the step onwards. It's smarter, it's more intuitive, it's more personalised to the individual child or the individual person. So I don't think that in itself is a problem, but I think when it's like this awkward pellet which you're attaching to your child's bed to wake them up in the morning, that's odd.
Now, Lizzie, we've sparred on this topic before.
Yes, we have.
And you bring up, I think we cited the cause of my hate as something that you've just mentioned, which is the Internet of You. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that, just so people know what it is?
Yeah, so kind of on a very basic level, a lot of the Internet of You things, it's basically technology that is linked to monitoring how we live, how our bodies work, how our bodies are functioning. And on a very basic level, this is, you know, stuff that we're all really used to, like pedometers and heart rate monitors, but building them in a smart way so they're connected to your phone, so that you're not having to carry around extra bits of gadgets, but you just have a chip in a wristband that monitors your heart rate and sends it to your smartphone. That's kind of where a lot of inventions at CES this year were going. And the mother, like we've kind of established, is kind of a very odd version of this. But I mean, it's the biggest craze at the moment. Like, everything is about wearable technology.
I don't understand why you need it. I just don't get
no.
it. Why do you need to know the temperature of the fridge?
The fridge says the temperature of the fridge. What's on the fridge?
Well, I think that's more actually kind of Internet of Things, which is kind of the flip side of the coin. So the kind of vision for Internet of Things is that you can have a smartphone which can control turning the lights on and off, can control running a bath, which sounds ridiculous, but we've seen it in films, sci-fi films, for such a long time.
See, that's I have less of a problem. I have less of a problem with that, because it is just, it's separate. Technology is doing one thing and you are doing another. It's this integration and the blurring of the lines.
You're afraid of being a cyborg.
I'm a little bit scared that Terminator might happen in real life. just a touch.
See, that's dependent on artificial intelligence, which we're so far away from being using in day-to-day life. Like, this is all just controlled by us. You can turn it off, you decide when you use it. And I think that unless we push the boundaries, we're never going to work out what we're capable of inventing.
Well, thank you very much, Lizzie and Emma, for coming in. Did we decide on what the worst invention of 2013 was?
It's obviously the periscope, but there's no function.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, all right.
I think in terms of most ridiculous, it's got to be the periscope, because who cares? Mm. But I think the mother, I think, as much as I can try and defend it, it's pretty creepy.
It is very creepy. Well, thank you very much, Lizzie and Emma, for coming in. That is it, guys. We have decided the worst invention of 2013 is
the periscope.
The periscope.
Tune in and hear York Talks on UOY.
Oh, well, that was a good discussion, wasn't it, Anna?
One sec, I'm sure the periscope was invented far before 2014.
Listen to the feature. It is a periscope called an iToy, which goes onto an iPad. So it's 3 foot tall, and you look into it, and it's to give the illusion of the people on the other end of your Skype call being further away.
What?
When actually, what you should do is just put the iPad over there, and have this 3 foot tall thing coming up. I thought, you can't even, if I stood up, I'm not tall enough to look into this periscope.
It's
the worst invention of 2013.
It's been a good edition of York Talks. Pilot show today, gone very well. We're going to be returning next year, aren't we? Next term. It's been good.
All the hard-hitting issues, all of the periscope news,
Got a few messages in as well. One relating to that last feature. Basically, worst invention of 2013, according to this message, is my diet while writing my dissertation.
At least they said invention. It implies a certain amount of creativity, which, listener, is healthy.
But also, we had someone message in about, from the University of York, Wi-Fi hotspot. Wherever that is, I don't know where that is.
That's anywhere on campus, George.
Relating
historical location.
Relating to the ethics and religion discussion we had just a few moments ago, and they said, if music is art, it should reflect life. How can you reflect the complexity of life if you overly censor yourself? What's the point of lyrics if they're limited to a certain limited portion of our lives? For example, a lot of hip-hop that grew out of the ghettos and references violence doesn't necessarily offend anyone. It's simply a reflection of those people's lives. How can we expect to make it family friendly when their lives growing up weren't family friendly? Quite a deep message.
Very good point.
Do remember, you can always send your messages into us, and we do love you doing that.
York Talks with George.
Torch Lane.
So, it's the end of tonight's show, the first ever York Talks on University Radio York. Big thank you to all the guest panellists who came in. Chair of the Lib Dems, Charlie Kingsbury, York Vision Editor, Callum Shannon, the Reverend Rowan Williams and Professor Peter Rowland. Of course, thank you to all our contributors as well from the UOY News, Speech and Sports team, everyone in the studios. It was a fantastic show, wasn't it, guys?
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah, we all loved it as well. Make sure to keep the debate going online and join us for the first show of the summer term next week. For now,
tune in and hear York Talks on UOY.
That was so cool. We're going to go. It's going very well there. Good hour. But now, Karius, are you ready?
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the news. It's 7 o'clock. You've been listening to York Talks. Thank you for listening. But here's Karius with the headlines.